So I'm going to spend the week of Teisho looking at the life and writings of Musō Sōseki. We know of Musō's writings from a few different sources, but I'll primarily be using Thomas Cleary's Dream Conversations, Thomas Kirshner's Dialogues in a Dream, and W.S. Merwin's Sun at Midnight, which includes Musō's poetry and also his West Mountain Evening Talks and admonitions. So you'll see in Musō's poetry his deep love and intimate relationship with nature. And from that love came the other thing Musō is known for, his landscape gardens, which he developed at both the monasteries he lived in and the many others that he visited for extended stays. So speaking about his gardens, he said, "The benevolent naturally love the silence of mountains. The wise naturally delight in the purity of water. So do not disdain the pleasure I take in landscape gardens. I'm simply attempting through them to refine my mind." So if you take a look at Sun at Midnight, you'll find poems that portray his deep love of garden making and the thin line between them and his Zen practice and teaching. So Musō lived from 1275 to 1351 of our common era. He started practicing as a young boy, but did not turn to Zen until he was present at the agonized death of a teacher in his non-Zen lineage. His faith was shaken on seeing the miserable death and the lack of effect of the many decades of practice of the dying monk. He wrote, saying about this death, that Buddhism has many paths, but all are directed towards leaving the world's dust behind and gaining the way. This lecture master was famous for his knowledge, but at the time of his death, it benefited him nothing. The Buddha Dharma is beyond the reach of learning and intellect. Is it not for this reason that the Zen school speaks of a separate transmission outside the teachings? So after the death of the teaching monk, Musō embarked on a 100-day solitary retreat. Near the end of the retreat, Musō had a dream, a makkyō, in which he was led to two Zen temples, the first Sōzon, and the second Sekito, named for two great Tang Dynasty Zen masters. His dream guide then handed him a scroll, which when unrolled had the image of Bodhidharma on it. This was metaphorically and literally Musō's entryway into the Zen sect. This dream gave the young practitioner his new Dharma name, Musō Sōseki. Musō means dream window, and Sōseki is the combining of the first characters of the two dream masters he met, Sōzon, so the So, and Sekito. Incidentally, Sekito in Chinese is Shi Tao Shi Chuan, the author of The Grass Roof Hermitage and The Coincidence of Opposites, which we read this morning during the sutra service. Over a number of years, Musō studied with different teachers, both in Kyoto and Kamakura. One day he went to his most current teacher and said, "I still have not clarified the matter of self. Please, Master, directly point the way." The teacher said, "Our school has no words or phrases and nothing to transmit to anyone." Musō said, "This may be so, but be compassionate and at least teach me an expedient means." The master declared, "There are no expedient means, nor is there any compassion." And from this time on, the teacher would say no more to Musō. This is quite a teaching for the first day of Sesshin, isn't it? this is why we take your keys when you first get here, so you can't just drive away. There is no room for motive, for advantage, for purpose, end, or goal. We don't do mu for a purpose. We don't sit with who hears and sounds with a goal. We don't count breath as means to an end. Each of these ways are not gateways or doors, but the very thing itself. You don't practice to become a Buddha, to become a kinder, sweeter person, to be more spiritual. You do this because, and to this point, it is the best way to express yourself. It's the best way to show yourself, all of yourself, just as you are. All of yourself in the ordinary and sacred, in the good and bad, in the wise and foolish ways that we are. Musso stayed with his teacher for some while and then went on pilgrimage, returning to temples occasionally for practice periods. Mostly he practiced alone or with a few friends or newly gathered monks in valleys and hilltops, near river, creeks, and the ocean, continually moving on as he deepened and clarified his practice and his growing insight, and as he deepened his life. One day, after some hours of zazen under a tree, the sun went down and the dark thickened. Musso stood and walked a path he knew well. He stumbled, and he reached for a wall to steady himself, but he missed the wall and he fell. Immediately, he started to laugh, and the entire universe cracked open. He later wrote, "For many years I dug in the earth searching for the blue sky. I piled useless things on top of each other again and again. One night in darkness, I saw that without a thought, I had smashed the bones of the vast blue sky." So there are no expedient means. There is simply without a thought. There is only forgetting the self. There is just mu doing mu. There are only sounds filling you, and just breath giving you shape and form. Let the schedule of session be your without a thought. Arriving when the bell sounds, eating after gathas, walking with clappers, and going to bed after the evening's encouragement. Let without a thought be your companion and be your guide. Let without a thought be your teacher and your dream, and the bones of the sky will break of their own. Please just keep returning to here, to now. Just return to your one and only practice and have faith. Tomorrow I'll continue with a little more of Musso's life story and practice. But now I'd like to look at section 91 from Dialogues in a Dream. The longtime student Ashikaga Tadayoshi, a founder and leader of the Muromachi Shogunate, asked him, "In the doctrinal schools they criticize Zen, saying, Zen's separate transmission outside the teachings neither follows the Buddha's discourses nor investigates the doctrines. It is no more than Zen's own arbitrary outlook and is unworthy of trust." Is there any merit to this criticism? And then Musso replied, and I'm only reading parts of his response. He said, "Those who make such criticisms know only the letter of the doctrine and not its spirit. If they understood the Buddha's true intention in expounding the teachings, then they would surely believe in the separate transmission outside the teachings. Those who do understand are the ones who deserve to be called true students of the doctrine. The Lankavatara Sutra says, from the beginning at the park and at the end at the river, the Buddha spoke not a single word. Given this passage, is there anything that the Buddha taught during his lifetime that should be adhered to as unchanging and real? The Sutra of Complete Enlightenment says the teachings of the sutras are like a finger pointing at the moon. The reason one uses a finger to point to the moon is to indicate the moon to other people. If these people look only at the finger, they cannot see the moon. If they then proceed to discuss the length of the finger and argue over whether it is large or small, surely that is the height of delusion. So Zen is a separate transmission outside of words, outside of the teachings and sutras. In all the years that Shakyamuni Buddha walked the earth, he spoke not a single word. The words and phrases of the Buddha who never spoke a single word are simply fingers pointing at the moon, but they are not the thing itself. And I hasten to add, nor is the moon being pointed at the thing itself. The fingers pointing are like a map of the countryside, but the map is not a mountain, a valley, a rocky slope, or a flat area without shade or water. The map is a finger, just like the raft. The raft is not the other shore. The raft is expedient means which actually do not exist either. And these means give us some indications of ways to practice for reaching what is unreachable. So there are some obvious contradictions here, aren't there? Or there at least seem to be. He never spoke a single word, and yet those words he never spoke are fingers pointing. And those fingers that point at a moon are actually pointing at a moon that isn't the thing itself either. And he says also that Zen is a separate transmission outside of the words, which were never spoken, and so on. So what is Musō getting at here? Are his words fingers? Are his words the moon? Or are his words something else entirely? What do you imagine is transmitted outside of the teachings? What did Musō realize when he fell into the night, cracking open the dark sky? At the time of his falling, he wrote, once in the dead of night, I tripped on a broken brick and kicked it into the air and saw that without a thought, I had smashed the bones of the empty sky. When we are without a thought, when we are before thought, ideas or concepts, when we are before words, the perceived walls of the mind dissipate, and there is only sky left, vast and blue. Zen speaks of a separate transmission outside the teachings. What is that? So Musō continued on in section 91 saying, but there are absolute words. These words transcend the level of verbal and nonverbal They are secret and wondrous words that are eternally expressed throughout past, present, and future. They must not be understood in the same way as words based on deluded attachments. Thus, there is a passage in a sutra in which the Tathagata says that in the realm of the ultimate mystery, fundamentally, I have no words. It is solely for the benefit of sentient beings that I preach. In the realm of enlightenment realized by the Tathagata, there is nothing for an observer to see or any words for a speaker to say. So I wonder what the kanji is that Musso used here and Kirchner translates as absolute. My guess is Musso was using the word mitsugo, which means intimate, absolute, hidden, secret, or mysterious. Intimate words, like absolute words, are not nouns, verbs, adjectives, or adverbs. Intimate words aren't modifiers or prepositions, and they cannot be declined because they do not have a past, future, or even a present tense. They aren't singular or plural. They do not stand in opposition or comparison to anything else. And yet, they do not stand alone. Intimate words are like two new lovers at night, entangled, joined with no beginning or end, with no front or back, with no top or bottom. These words and phrases of intimacy are so in sync with circumstances and conditions that we can say that they are those very conditions and circumstances. The words and the speaker are not two. In fact, they aren't even one. And they do not stand outside of and explain or describe. They are embedded in. They are this. When intimate words are called hidden or secret, it is only because the one hearing is still holding herself outside of feelings and sensations, outside of thoughts and notions. She's holding herself outside of her conditions and circumstances. When we stand or sit, walk or lie down outside of, the intimacy of words, phrases, and actions are shaded and seem to attract objects, verbs, and subjects. They appear to stick to tense and modifiers, to adjectives and adverbs. They seem to describe, explain, and compare. In case 23 of the Gateless Gate, we find Hui Neng being chased by the head monk Ming, who wants to recover the sacred bowl and robe taken by the young man under cover of night. Ming finally caught up with Hui Neng, and the young man said, "Take the bowl and robe. There should be no fighting over them." Ming tried to lift them, but found them to be as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for these items. Please open the way for me." Hui Neng said, "Don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had a great realization experience. Sweat ran from his body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Besides these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" Hui Neng said, "What I have conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you as you." In this way, the secret and hidden become what they have always been, intimate. This is why even on this first day of Sesshin, you do not have to do mu or count breath. This is why you do not have to do who hears. This doing makes those beautiful practices into something separate, into something secret. The doing makes practice into an object. The doing makes mu into an object. And ultimately, it makes your life into an object. Let mu do you. Let the sounds of insects and birds, of shuffling and shooting, let the sounds fill you. Let the numbers give you shape. Have faith, confidence that at this point, the past and future aren't necessary, and even the present moment is an abstraction and is too also unnecessary. Those ideas keep you from being intimate. They keep this hidden. They make it into a secret, into who knows and who doesn't. Let your zazen do you. Let it be you. Don't be caught by the extraneous, by the robe and bowl, by searching for what is already looking from your own eyes. Musso said it like this: the sounds of the stream splash out the Buddha's sermon. Don't say that the deepest meaning comes only from one's mouth. Day and night, 80,000 poems arise one after the other. And in fact, not a single word has ever been spoken. The words and phrases that have never been spoken are continually calling you. They're calling for you to come home. The robin and bush tits are calling. The sound of raven and crows, the gunshots and yells, even this talk and your neighbor's sigh are all calling, yearning. They're desiring for you to come back to the home that you never actually left. The more we search, the more hidden it appears to be. The more we search, the more faith we put in pointing fingers, in words and phrases that have objects, subjects, and verbs. Put it down. Put everything down. Let the practice, your life, be the moon that needs no fingers pointing. Let the utter intimacy of right here, of right now. Let the utter intimacy of the gentle breeze moving through the leaves. Let this be enough.